meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hey, hello everyone. God bless you for tuning into The Winds of Change. Father Tom Coy is here with you on a brain-wrinkling Wednesday. It happens to be All Saints Day today. Hope you get a chance to get to Mass. It is at the Mass we should concentrate on all the saints because we enter into a different dimension, right? When you enter into church for Mass, something of a sixth dimension.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago.
Hello. One, two, three.
We're here.
One, two. now I can hear you. We're dropping in and out. I'm sorry.
As they say, carry on.
Carry on. Let's keep it going. I hope we can get through this beautiful show, a little time together. I want to share with you some meanderings. First, about All Saints Day. Then I got to share with you an interesting, important insight, a philosophical insight. One of the great problems of our society today that is, it's everywhere, but it's not noticed. Just like a virus that goes unnoticed. A cancer that is undetected. We must uncover nominalism and attack it for the silliness that it is. Anyways, okay. A little thought on All Saints Day. Of course, you probably maybe know that All Saints Day is a day for those unknown saints. I've brought to the attention of my people when talking on All Saints Day. Let's name as many of the wonderful saints. How many patron saints can you name? What are their feast days? And that's certainly a good exercise to do. But the spirit of All Saints Day is more about all those saints in heaven that don't have their own date on the calendar. You know, so instead of talking about St. Francis of Assisi or St. Thomas Aquinas or St. Nicholas or St. Joseph, or even the Blessed Mother, she's the Queen of All Saints, of course. All Saints Day is really a day that we are supposed to recognize, realize that there's lots of saints in heaven that we don't know of. As a matter of fact, All Saints Day started pretty early in the church as primarily a feast to commemorate the martyrs, the early martyrs of the church. And of course, there were some big names like Ignatius of Antioch, Felicity and Perpetua, Saint Sebastian, all the 12 apostles were martyred. You know, in just reading it, we always say the 12 apostles, well, 11 apostles were martyred. And we make the exception that St. John wasn't martyred. He died of old age on the island of Patmos. But did you know that they tried to kill him? They threw him in a vat of boiling oil and didn't hurt him. So they figured, let's just exile him. This guy's got protection from on high. We don't want him around. So they send him to the island of Patmos. As we think about the saints, it is kind of natural to gravitate to the stories of the martyrs. Their sad and violent ending is just captivating. There's no doubt about it. And so it is good to remember them and to draw strength from their courage, obviously. Yet it's so very, very important to realize that a lot of the saints weren't martyred. You know what I learned not too long ago regarding saints? Maybe you know that there's different categories of saints. And if you've ever seen a priest flipping through that big red book on the altar when he's can't find the right page, right? This happens to me every now and then. Even though I try to know that big red book called the Missal. Anyways, a lot of times what the priest is looking for is the proper preface. That's the prayer after the, right before the holy, 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 and going into the consecration prayer, you know, the Eucharistic prayer. Anyways, the prefaces, there's different categories of prefaces. And some are for martyrs. Some are for religious men and women. Some of the prefaces are for virgins. There's a category, you know, that used to be in the old Roman Missal, but it's not in the new one, and I'm a little disappointed. They're called confessors. And I do remember learning that confessors doesn't mean just saints that were good confessors in the sense that they were a priest and you went to confession and you liked the priest. Or we might remember stories of St. Padre Pio or John Vianney who would have long, long lines of penitence. They would have the ability to read souls. They would sometimes be strong with their penitence, other times of obviously always merciful, but that gift of reading souls is amazing. Anyway.
Wow. You just wrinkled my brain, man.
That is a brain wrinkler, no doubt. And yet the category of saints called confessors isn't really about priests who are good confessors. Confessors is a category of saints that were almost martyred. They died usually in prison or after being beaten to a bloody pulp, left for dead but didn't die. They were punished so severely that they died of their wounds, or they were left on an island or given such great punishment that, anyways, that's what the confessors are. The confessors are people that confessed their faith until the end, even though they may not have been martyred. They're kind of a category of martyrs. I don't know if I'd rather be a full-fledged red martyr or a confessor, because the full-fledged red martyr, his pain was obviously intense, but not that long and carried out. Whereas a confessor may suffer in a prison or something like that for many months, as it were. So, anyways, today is the feast of All Saints Day. Here's part of what made me think of our tendency to focus on the martyrs, which is they have a high ranking in the hierarchy of saints. If you can say so, once you're in heaven, everyone. Well, I was just about to say, but I thought of a teaching of Thomas Aquinas and G.K. Chesterton that says, in heaven, equality is not what we think, or there is a hierarchy in heaven. So there is a hierarchy of happiness in heaven, everyone will be 100% happy in heaven, but there is a hierarchy, just like there would be a hierarchy on earth. So, but our love for the martyrs is reasonable, and our interest is reasonable. We just had a wonderful All Saints Day night with our children. We had a lot of the CCD students acting out little dramas of the lives of the saints, and of course we had them dressed up as saints to come in. It's really it's such a delightful activity. I really wish most of our Catholic schools and our CCD programs emphasize the lives of the saints more than the regular Halloween stuff, the trick-or-treating stuff, as it were. Here's what I want to mention here. The idea that martyrs grab our attention is obviously because they suffer so much. I want to connect this to the idea that G.K. Chesterton talks about in his wonderful book, The Everlasting Man, to the idea that Christians, as they were being martyred, were holding on to a more optimistic and joyful form of life than the ones who were putting them to death. He Chesterton likes to take the criticisms that are levied against Catholicism and point out how silly those criticisms are. And one of the silly criticisms is that the martyrs and all the saints, really Catholicism in general, has a pessimistic attitude of life. Catholicism makes you forget about the goodness of life, the goodness of nature, and teaches you to hate yourself and the world and existence in general. And so I think his response is worth pointing out, because let's see how to explain this. A martyr who's willing to accept death rather than turn to sin, deny their faith, is actually, I gotta check something here, my friends. Let's see, there we go. It's obvious, you can easily see how critics of Catholicism would criticize Catholicism for being negative about life when someone is willing to die instead of put a little incense on a plate to worship the king as a god or the emperor as a god, or anytime Christianity or some saintly person, doesn't have to be a canonized saint, but any of us who try to defend what chastity is, for instance. To live a chaste life is to deny yourself certain pleasures, and that is responded to by many critics by saying Catholicism is very negative. It has a pessimistic view of life and reality, where Chesterton says the opposite is really true. Martyrs were holding fast to the more positive, optimistic view of life over and against the negative and vicious form of life that the world around them praised. In other words, the world that was being promoted by those who were willing to kill the Christians, they were promoting a world that, well, they'll say, is a killer be killed kind of existence. Life has no real eternal meaning. Your suffering has no real redeeming quality. So therefore, the goal, the purpose of life is to have as much pleasure and earthly joy as you can. And the saints, especially the martyrs, saw that attitude was a very pessimistic, very negative attitude about life. And therefore, they were embracing martyrdom to teach the world that the ways of the world were responsible for the violent, warlike, hatred-filled existence that we have, you know. So I think that's a great insight that we could use for today. For instance, we all know that there's a lot of bad things going on in the world. You read the newspaper and you watch TV, you check the news, and let's face it, we're all kind of attracted to the train wreck. We're all kind of interested in bad news. That's why if it bleeds, it leads, as they say in journalism, right? And so we will, I'm checking here again. I'm hoping we're still just going along fine here. Sorry about that, my friends. Okay. So we got to get over the fact that because martyrs were martyred and they accepted death, we have to realize that they, and you and I, are the harbingers of a positive, joyful form of life. And it's the bad news around us that makes us think this is a really vicious and cruel world. And we know why, because they're not accepting the true God and his commandments, his ways of life. They're fighting against God and therefore are creating a terrible, pessimistic, meaningless life. And so it's the Christian doctrines that give us that light. And it's the heresies that are named by the church that protect that more optimistic, more positive view of life. Chesterton points out that a lot of people like to criticize the church for being so negative, but Chesterton points out that the church herself called being too negative about life a heresy. The Manichaean heresy is one of the big ones that comes to mind. You know, how could the church be criticized for being for promoting a negative view of life when it condemns as a heresy the Manichaeans who were stars and poster children of the negative view of life? It's beautiful, very interesting. Combination there. I want to touch on, well, I think we'll take our first break now. Okay, Armin there. We'll take our first break. I want to talk especially about the amazing story of Saint Hippolytus and Pope Pontius, because it deals with the negativism of life and the way the Catholic Church points out bad things going on, but always encourages a joyful way of approaching life, as it were, okay? Anyways, let's take that first break. I'm Father Tom Coyes. You're listening to The Winds of Change. We are AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Koska Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more. providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Koska Academy is conveniently located one block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststandschicago.org. ststandschicago.org.
I'm Father Tom Coyes, and you are listening to The Winds of Change.
Here is an update on the Fulton Sheen petition.
We Catholics stand just inches from the goal line to have the saint we desperately need now, Venerable Fulton Sheen, publicly declared blessed. Yet new obstacles keep arising to delay this from happening. The Diocese of Peoria is now requiring the unanimous support of the U.S. bishops behind the beatification of Fulton Sheen before a new date is set for the ceremonial Mass. This has never been necessary in the Church's history. The Fulton Sheen Movement's petition drive to set a new date soon for Sheen's beatification Mass now has 10,000 Catholics from around the world clamoring for this. We need this voice magnified by hundreds of thousands more Catholics. And you can help us do that. Take action. Go to FultonSheenMovement.com and sign the petition and share it everywhere, because everyone agrees we need Blessed Fulton Sheen now more than ever.
Bye now, and God love you.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Father Coyes here on a brain-wrinkling Wednesday. It's the Feast of All Saints Day. Here I found an interesting quote from Chesterton's Everlasting Man, where he's trying to explain this false criticism of Catholicism being too negative, or a negative view of life, as it were. He says, the early church was aesthetic, meaning like not in step with contemporary society, prayerful, otherworldly, as it was. But she, the church, proved that she was not pessimistic, simply because she condemned pessimists. The creed declared that man was sinful, but it did not declare that life was evil, and it proved it by condemning those who did proclaim the evilness of life. The condemnation of the early heretics is itself condemned as something crabbed and narrow. You know how somebody would say, oh, why wouldn't those early heretics have been allowed to teach what they taught? Because they should have had a freedom of thought and freedom of speech. And the church, by sanctioning, calling some people heretics, was narrow-minded of them. That's, I'm sure, a common thought for a lot of people today, but Chesterton goes on, but it was in truth, it meaning the naming of heretics and heresies, but it was in truth the very proof that the church meant to be brotherly and broad. It proved that the primitive Catholics were especially eager to explain that they did not think man utterly vile. Which, of course, is what people use as the foundation for doing bad things all the time. If man is utterly vile, then it's a dog-eat-dog world, and a killer-be-killed proceeds from that. So the church was strong at pointing out what's sin, but it dealt with the fallenness of human nature, not the depravity or the evilness of human nature. They, the early Christians, did not think life incurably miserable. They did not think marriage a sin or procreation a tragedy. Gosh, that reminds me of, I've been reading a book called The Family Row. Very interesting story about Nora McCorvey, written by kind of a pro-choice author, but someone, he tries to be balanced, and it's very detailed, very, it's kind of a long book too, but it's a very detailed narrative about the one person, Nora McCorvey, who was the Roe of Roe versus Wade. And there's a constant reference. The phrase is used not only in that book, but by so many of us today. She found herself pregnant, or they were together for a while, and they found themselves. She found herself pregnant. The idea of someone finding yourself pregnant is sort of like what Chesterton is criticizing here, that procreation is a tragedy. It's kind of like you find yourself in a mud puddle, or you find yourself with a disease, or you find yourself lost in the woods, or whatever. But the idea of finding yourself in such a condition without recognizing that it's a natural condition of actions that we do is part of what Chesterton is speaking against here. So, okay, I gotta tell you one of my very interesting stories, since like talking about this difference between being positively inclined or negatively inclined. By the way, Chesterton says in other writings that Christianity or a saintly Christian life isn't just to be equated with the idea of being positive is for good and negative is for evil. And Chesterton says there's both good and evil in the world, so that us Christians should be positive at times and we should be negative at times. But that sense that life is evil, or that the criticism that martyrs or Catholics in general have a bad view of life is very popular. And there's a story between two early saints that I think it's worth pointing out. The story of Saint Hippolytus and Saint Pope Pancius. Now they're both saints, but Hippolytus only became a saint at the end of his life. He was martyred, but the guy was an anti-pope, actually. And one of the problems of the early church, and we get it, we hear it now and then, when people call traditional Catholics too rigid. There was a heresy in the early church called rigorism, and Hippolytus is a good example of it. And part of where it grew out of was in the time of persecution, some Christians obviously were martyred, but other Christians sort of ran away from martyrdom. They either denied their faith or skedaddled, or they obeyed the soldiers who were trying to get them to do something against, you know, for the recognition of the divinity of the emperor or something. Anyways, Hippolytus was one of the guys who was upset with those Christians who ran away from martyrdom. And so he was condemning them and requiring them to be baptized again. Okay, you had your chance, you blew it, you better start over again and get baptized again. And one of the other leaders in the church at that time, this is like in the 200s, was a pope by the name of Pontius. And he was like, no, we shouldn't be baptizing him again. And we can't condemn them to hell for just saving their life, as it were. Not, in other words, we can't condemn them to hell for not accepting martyrdom. And so that was an interesting debate at that time. Hippolytus then himself gets arrested by the emperor, and now his life is on the line. And when he was exiled, again, to an island, like a work camp. And so he's being punished by the emperor. Obviously, if he was mad at Christians who didn't go to martyrdom for disobeying the emperor had him on his hit list. So who's trying to diminish my divine power as emperor? Well, this guy Hippolytus is one of the big leaders, so arrest him. And they arrested him. They put him in on the prison camp island, what have you, probably breaking rocks or something, whatever we can imagine. Anyways, lo and behold, guess who he meets on the same island being punished, and that is Pope Pontius. So now they're both, their heads are on the line, and Hippolytus realizes the difficulty it is in being a great saint and being a martyr. I didn't want to be martyred, and so he felt that, number one, we're not going to rebaptize people. We can be disappointed in someone who runs away from martyrdom, but we can't condemn someone to hell for that. Boy, I think of that oftentimes when there's a very difficult moral issue being discussed. The woman who's pregnant with a ectopic pregnancy, where the baby's in the fallopian tube, and they say if we don't abort the baby, you're going to die. And there have been Saint Gianna Mola was one of the women who did accept martyrdom in that sense of I'd if it comes between, if it's a choice between me and the baby, save the baby, and I'll go, I'll die. And of course, that's a great saint. She's a great hero. But a lot of people are not that strong and aren't able to make that kind of decision. And so they're forgiven, obviously, if the person is sorry and they sees it as a sign of weakness. I don't have the strength to endure that kind of martyrdom one way or another. It reminds me a little bit on the political world of what's going on with, do you remember the woman lawyer, what's her name, Sidney? She was helping President Trump with the cases of the ballots being tampered with and laws being passed in order to make cheating easier. And she recently pleaded guilty to, this is going on in Georgia, I think, even now. Anyways, she was pleading guilty, and even though she was doing it as a, I'm sure she believed it at the time, and I think she probably still believes it now today, but she pleaded guilty because the ones who were trying to eventually get to Trump were going to destroy all his friends, and she was pleading guilty to save her life, so to speak. It's kind of reminiscent of an early Christian who's going to put the incense in the bowl to bow to the emperor rather than die. And so that's the kind of situation that we find all the time, isn't it? So the fact that martyrs are often the most interesting, the most fascinating kind of saints is natural, and it will always be that way. Yet we have to appreciate the fact that that the church encourages martyrdom, but it's going to understand folks that that can't handle it. And that's the way to avoid an objective assessment of something that is sinful, and yet allowing a certain kind of love and forgiveness. As I say, a woman with a pregnancy that may kill her. You can even do that with someone struggling with same-sex attraction, right? Here's a person, they don't have the wherewithal to overcome those attractions. So that, and the church can't say that it's right, it's a good, it's gay relations are still sinful, but a person who can't follow God's ways, it's a different way of looking at it. They're not strong enough to live the martyr's life, or to die the martyr's life, die to something inside of themselves. They're going to take a pass, shall we say. So the church has to maintain the moral objective code, but it recognizes that now is someone leaving a homosexual lifestyle really suffering like Saint Felicity or Perpetua or John the Baptist or all the apostles? They're not really shedding their blood. Is it really suffering to step out of the gay lifestyle? Some people will say yes, though they don't really give, shall we say, either a heterosexual lifestyle or a celibate lifestyle a chance. They're just, shall we say, so addictive to the pleasure that they have with the gay lifestyle, right? Anyways, okay. Let's take another break, and I want to get to this philosophical issue of nominalism. It's a philosophical disease that must be, number one, understood, and number two, opposed. All right. So let's take our next break. This is The Winds of Change. I'm Father Tom Coyes. You're listening to the wonderful Winds of Change program on AM 750. We are WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka, the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, is open 24 hours a day, 7 days per week, for adoration of the Blessed Sacrament in the iconic monstrance. The Blessed Sacrament is reposed during the celebration of Mass and during special events. St. Stan's doors are always open for adoration. Come anytime, day or night. St. Stan's is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, right off the Kennedy. Visit ststanschurch.org.
We are the students of St. Stanislaus Academy.
Your children can join them for face-to-face classroom instruction. Visit ststanschicago.org. to find out how.
And you're listening to The Winds of Change.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic, social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy is conveniently located 1 block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststanschicago.org. ststanschicago.org.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. God bless you first. Oh, wait a minute. That was my cue coming on here. Okay, the reason we got to talk about a heresy. Well, I don't think it's officially called a heresy in the church, but it's a fallacy philosophically. There probably are certain condemnations of nominalism. Nominalism is that segment of philosophy we kind of call epistemology. How do we know things? And what's our relationship to reality, our brain to reality? And it's on my mind a lot because I'm going through the Obergefell Supreme Court decision, the one that legalized gay marriage throughout our country. I also like to say it in terms of made it possible for priests like myself to be a criminal if I don't follow the law of the Supreme Court. No priest has been jailed for not marrying a gay couple yet, but the Obergefell ruling of the Supreme Court sets the stage for exactly that to happen, even though the courts or the government will say there's exceptions. That's always the way things start, and the exception will be eliminated by litigation. Somebody will challenge that exception, and the way the Obergefell case came down is just wrought with it will make such a case very easy to win on the part of gay couples. So, but let's discuss what nominalism means, and its opposing philosophical worldview is usually just referred to as realism. Realism, and the classic philosopher that promoted realism is Aristotle. And he's kind of on an opposite side of the fence as Plato, though Plato believes in a realism that just doesn't exist in this world. we're always just in images here, and reality is beyond this world. And a man of faith can accept Plato's vision in some ways, because we'll say that real reality is only in heaven, but we don't deny that this world is real. It's not just images. It's not pictures. I'm going to take this from a very interesting article by Andrea Borghini. Don't know too much about her, but it's got a very concise, good definition of realism versus nominalism. So here she goes. Nominalism and realism are the two most distinguished positions in Western metaphysics dealing with the fundamental structure of reality. According to realists, all entities can be grouped into two categories, particulars and universals. Nominalists instead argue that there are only particulars, okay? No universals. What does that mean? Most people, when they think of universals, probably thinks of Universal Studios in Florida, where Disney World is and all that, but that's something much different. Universals are different than particulars. Particulars are like the chair I'm sitting on, the house I'm in, the tree I'm looking at. But a universal would be something that this chair that I'm sitting in shares in, because I know there's a lot of other chairs, and every chair has a participation in, sometimes philosophers say, chairness, that there is, the chair is not just a chair because I say it's a chair. It's because it is participating in what a chair needs to be. Are you following me? Let me read a little bit more of how she says it. Realists postulate the existence of two kinds of entities, particulars and universals. Particulars resemble each other because they share universals. For example, each particular dog has four legs, can bark, and has a tail. Universals can also resemble each other by sharing other universals. For example, wisdom and generosity resemble each other in that they are both virtues. So Plato and Aristotle were among the most famous realists, although Plato was a different kind of realist than Aristotle. Okay? The intuitive plausibility of realism is evident. Realism allows us to take seriously the subject-predicate structure of discourse through which we represent the world. The subject-predicate structure. This chair is brown. This chair is the subject. Tom is a man. Those are the name, the subject, and the predicate. The predicate often points to that universal, and it makes a lot of sense to us. When we say that Socrates is wise, it is because there are both Socrates, the particular, and wisdom, the universal. And the particular exemplifies the universal. Or sometimes the word participates is used. It participates. It exemplifies the universal. Realism also can explain the use we often make of abstract references. Sometimes qualities are subjects of our discourse. Quite often, right? Qualities are subject of our discourse. As we say that wisdom is a virtue or that red is a color, the realist can interpret these discourses as asserting that there is a universal wisdom or red that exemplifies another universal virtue or color, right? So there's these related categories, related qualities, and it makes sense to our mind that wants to accept what we see and what we get. You know, you are what you see is what you get. Or you, if you bump your head into a wall, the wall is real. If you're in a room where other people have disease, you might catch the disease. It's not all in your mind, as it were. There's still a lot of people that are wearing masks, right, for the COVID, that attempt to stay, keep away from disease by wearing their masks is still in a lot of people's minds. It's they're realists in that sense. They really believe that a disease can be prevented by wearing the mask. I'm a realist and I don't wear a mask yet, but still, if I believed the virus was, if the mask was going to help, I would wear it. The reason I don't wear a mask is because I don't think it helps. And as a matter of fact, I want my body to have some, to build up its kind of immune system. And the way bodies build up immune systems is by getting a little bit of the disease and fighting it off, and then getting another little bit of a disease and fighting it off. That's the way we mostly get through life without getting all these diseases. But of course, when nobody gets out of life alive, and somewhere along the line, you're going to get caught by it. Okay, so that's what the realists, how they understand reality. Now, how do nominalists understand reality? And think of this philosophical term in terms of the debate over Obergefell, the gay rights issue. Nominalists offer a radical definition of reality. They say, there are no universals. The only things that exist are particulars. The basic idea is that the world is made exclusively from particulars, and the universals are of our own making. They stem from our representational system, the way we think about the world, or from our language, the way we speak of the world. Because of this, nominalism is clearly tied in a close manner also to epistemology, the study of what distinguishes justified belief from opinion. Let me read that line there again. That's pretty important. Because of this, nominalism is clearly tied in a close manner also to epistemology, the study of what distinguishes justified belief from opinion. In other words, epistemology, the study of knowledge. In the study of knowledge, you want to know that you are learning truths. All knowledge is not just opinion. See, so this is a problem with the Obergefell decision, because at the very beginning of the Obergefell, the briefs or the court's opinion, whenever the Supreme Court hands down an opinion, there's the court's opinion and there's the dissenter's opinions. Amazingly, both the court's opinion and the dissenter opinions were written by Catholics. Justice Kennedy was the one who wrote the opinion of the court that legalized gay marriage. Justice Scalia was the one who wrote the dissenting opinion that said courts should not legalize marriage in this way. But at the very beginning, he frames the argument in the nominalist way by referring to marriage as a concept. He talks about the concept of marriage that has been existing for a long time, and he's not that stupid to say that it hasn't been around as man and woman for most of human history until the last 10 years. So he knows it, but he approaches it as a concept, and a concept that is not rooted in any reality, any physical reality. It's marriage itself is our mental way of describing some kind of relationship, and it's not rooted in the physical human bodies. It's marriage, in his humble estimation, which is incorrect as far as I'm concerned, he's saying the concept of marriage has been around, and we have accepted it as between a man and a woman for so many millennia. But because the concepts have changed, our thinking about marriage, same-sex unions, has changed. It is time for the law to catch up with the new understanding. So you see how nominalism is at work right from the get-go, and that leads to the idea that you don't have to link our ideas of things with things in the world. If you took it out of the sexual ethics arena and applied the logic of Justice Kennedy in the Obergefell, let's take it first in the arena of sports, and you were to say, for ever since the beginning of baseball, a man who hits the ball and it goes over the fence, over left field, gets to run around the bases, and we call that a home run. But our understanding of a home run has changed so much, so that now we need to make new rules in baseball that would say, if you hit the ball over the left field wall, you get an out. You don't get a run, you get an out. And you're going to say, well, the baseball commission, the commissioner has a right to change the rules of baseball. Gosh, I was watching, I haven't watched a lot of baseball lately, just because of the whole professional baseball, the whole professional sports world is so woke, as it were, and they're just millionaires having a lot of fun, and we're all enthralled with watching them. So anyways, but there's some new rules. One of the new rules, of course, was the pitcher didn't have to bat. Now, this is the new rule I just saw this year, that there's a pitch clock. I didn't know there was a pitch clock. Just like in football, you got to snap the ball a certain before the play clock goes off. Anyways, so we readily recognize the fact that an artificial game invented by humans can change rules about that particular game, but we can't take it upon ourselves to define or to say that a bat is not a bat and a ball is not a ball. The bat, with its particular instant, being the bat in the batter's hand at the moment, that's the particular, and the universal batness, if you were an anomalist, you would say, okay, I'm going to give my player a cannon, and it will accept the ball that's pitched. It has a big like funnel in front of it. Okay, oh, stay with me here. When the ball comes, it gets sucked into the cannon, and then it fires, and it always goes over the left field wall, home run, right? And somebody will say, well, that's not a bat. And you say, yes, it is. We're going to change the definition of a bat. You say a bat is what a man holds in his hand when the pitcher is pitching him the ball. And so I invented a bat that always hits home runs. So you're going to have an argument over what a bat is. But a nominalist will be perfectly comfortable with that. But of course, no baseball fan will be comfortable with it. But you see where I'm going, that the nominalism destroys the connection between our mind and reality. That is a bat only because I say it's a bat. And if two people are debating about what's a true bat, too bad, I get to maintain my definition, your definition. Anyways, thanks for listening, everybody. I think that's our hour together. I am Father Tom Boys. You're listening to The Winds of Change on AM750 WNDC.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now.